Now, in the midst of COVID-19 vaccine distribution, there's a big question facing policymakers at all levels. How do you decide who gets a potentially life-saving vaccine next? The U.S. vaccine program is behind the schedule laid out by federal health officials. As of late December, only about a fifth of available vaccine in the country had been used. And there have been issues about access. For example, in Milwaukee, most COVID vaccines so far have gone to young white residents, though the pandemic has disproportionately affected communities of color and older people. Same is true in the country at large, with vaccination rates for white Americans 2 to 3 times higher in some places. Wisconsin health officials decided this week to move up people 65 and older on the priority list. The health department says the decision was based on the fact that people in that age group are at risk of serious illness or death. And from a global perspective, you're way more likely to have access to a vaccine if you live in a wealthy country. You could join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about vaccine priorities. Who do you think should be at the top of the list or near the top of the list for receiving the limited supply of coronavirus vaccines? Are you an essential worker yourself? Have you received one? Do you know where you are on the list? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nicole Hassoun is a professor of philosophy at Binghamton University in New York and a visiting scholar at Cornell University. She's the director of Global Health Impact, an organization that seeks to expand healthcare access for the poor. Her latest book is Global Health Impact, Extending Access to Essential Medicines. Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we've had this rollout not going on very long now with vaccines. What stands out to you when it comes to the way at the national and state levels we've prioritized who gets vaccines first and next?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're doing a lot better than some countries. We have distributed, I think, about 3 or 4 vaccines per 100 people in our population, and it's fairly equitably distributed between states. But there's a long way to go. There's countries like Israel that have already gotten 30 doses for every 100 people out there. Some of the problems that we've been facing are, you know, poor coordination between federal governments and states, some poor guidance given in different states. But one of the issues is that the manufacturing of vaccines is really difficult. So you don't just need the principal ingredients, but you need things like glass vials, rubber stoppers, the lipids and other components that go into those. And we have to get those vaccines to people. So there's the cold chain that needs to be in place. The kind of vaccines we have in the U.S. are these mRNA vaccines. They're a new technology. We're creating new manufacturing systems to create them. Those are supposed to be easier, but then the resulting vaccines are very much more difficult to distribute, especially Pfizer's, which requires this ultra cold storage. So getting it to rural areas, for instance, is pretty difficult. I think there's some geopolitics that are also playing a role. So there's a competition globally for this vaccine. And so Pfizer, for instance, said to the EU recently, we're not going to be able to provide you with the doses we promised. Also, you know, even in the US, it seems like that's maybe not happening quite as quickly as everybody had hoped. Countries are restricting the exports of vaccines, are trying to prioritize their populations first. Even the US, you know, had an executive order to try to constrain that vaccine distribution. So I guess I'd like to see, you know, I would like to see things done a little bit differently. I'd love to see more cooperation and collaboration and funding into that manufacturing system that would support efforts globally to distribute the vaccines as well as, you know, in our area.
Yeah, before we key in on kind of local decisions on who to prioritize first, I want to pursue that point about internationally. What are you seeing happening with especially lower income countries around the world and their ability to get and distribute vaccines?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, we talk about cold chain being difficult here in parts of, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, 28% of facilities lack consistent electricity supply. So even having refrigeration is extremely difficult, and getting people to those health centers, you know, it can take a full day's travel to get someone to a health center to get vaccinated. And I think one of the most important things we should do is put kind of a basic health system in place for everyone. We need to fund public health. We need to do it in this country. But globally, if we don't prepare well for the next pandemic, which is likely going to be much worse than this one, then I think we're really in a bad place. We need to be able to vaccinate people much more quickly than we are. There's some efforts to do this. So there's a, something called the COVAX initiative, which is a collaboration of, you know, countries coming together. Unfortunately, the United States hasn't joined COVAX, but they've come together to accelerate the manufacture and distribution of vaccines globally and aim to help 20% of the global population get the vaccine quickly. And I could definitely talk about some more of the, you know, the problems that we have in getting the vaccines to people in poor countries if you'd like.
Briefly, before we move on to how we distribute in the United States, what other roadblocks are there? Surmountable, hopefully, roadblocks are there.
For sure. I mean, I think that, you know, it's not, people do get vaccinated. So I think UNICEF is providing on a regular basis vaccines for about half the world's children. But there's big gaps too. So not only, you know, in terms of health facilities and cold chain supplies and distribution networks and the provision of the vaccines themselves, but even health workers, right? There's kind of a global competition for healthcare personnel, and we need to have people who can administer the vaccine. So you see things like the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, effectively building a second shadow national health system in India of 900,000 workers. What we should be doing is sustaining basic health services and infrastructure in place for everyone, which would allow us to overcome diseases like polio and, you know, other diseases like, you know, COVID that are threatening people.
Talking to Nicole Hassoun from Binghamton University, talking about the ethics of vaccine distribution and priorities. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Given that we don't have enough vaccines at this point and we won't for a while to vaccinate everybody, who do you think should be at the top of the list or next on the list after that first round? You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and with your questions, 800-642-1234. Well, with that question of how the U.S. and state governments decide who goes next, Wisconsin started, as many states did, with frontline health workers and older people, and that older age just got lowered to 65 now. I want to listen to Deputy Secretary of the State Health Services Department, Julie Willems-Van Dyke, talking about that decision.
If you look at our death data around who has perished from this disease, it is disproportionately people in older age groups. And the reason we went ahead before everything was tidied up is because people are dying from COVID-19.
And Nicole, you've written about that being a pretty good priority, that seniors being at most at risk should logically be among the first vaccinated. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, for sure. So the CDC, you know, issued some guidelines, which many states are following. Initially, they were thinking about kind of putting older people much lower down on the list than they did. And I wrote this op-ed and some other people wrote op-eds, you know, and things to say, hey, you know, we tend not to prioritize the most needy. And it's clearly the elderly in this case. So if you're, you know, a healthy 20-year-old, your chance of dying from COVID is like driving 7,500 miles in the U.S. If you are 70 or 80, your chance of dying is like climbing Mount Everest. So if you care about saving the greatest number of lives, it's pretty clear you ought to focus on helping people who are older. And so that's what I was advocating for. And I think that that came some way towards that conclusion. So they have prioritized healthcare personnel, residents of long-term care facilities first, but then everyone who's 75 or older and frontline essential health workers. And then they're supposed to go to 65 or older and people with high-risk medical conditions and other essential workers. But there's a lot of people in that essential worker category. And you know, I think there's still room for, you know, wiggle debate, I guess, about, you know, do you want to prioritize teachers over the elderly and this kind of thing? But states are doing it different ways. You know, I think what's really, really sad is when people aren't able to exercise kind of common sense and get as many vaccines into people's arms as possible, even if it might not be exactly the right priority. Because if you see those vaccines going to waste, it's, you know, a life that could have been saved.
Right. I've seen reports in some communities, I think including New York City, that, okay, we've got these vaccines. We're trying to get into the priority groups. If we have a batch of 30 that it's use them or lose them by midnight or whatever, they put out the word and say, hey, get over here, stand in line. We might have a vaccine for you, whatever group you're in. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's much better that it's not perfectly equitable, that we get it into somebody's arms, but rather than let it go to waste. I mean, in New York, I think the governor, it took a few days to kind of get that message that, you know, when they couldn't get it out to people, you shouldn't kind of penalize them for giving it to a different group. I mean, of course, we don't want people, you know, manipulating the process and jumping in line, because if you go ahead and get it and you're a healthy 25-year-old or a 40-year-old and, you know, your neighbor isn't necessarily going to get it for, you know, a few months. And that could be very dangerous if they're much older, for instance.
We're talking about the ethics of vaccines and the COVID-19 vaccine priority list we've seen at the federal and state levels and internationally, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts? Are there groups you think should be prioritized? We've heard the case for grocery workers lately in Wisconsin, in contact with a lot of people. Deb writes on the Ideas Network Facebook page, grocery workers should get prioritized. Our guest just mentioned teachers as a possibility. Who do you want to see getting the limited supply of vaccines next? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with medical ethicist Nicole Hassoun about how to decide who gets the COVID vaccine next, what the priorities should be. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page with your thoughts. Let's talk about some other priorities, Nicole. One is stopping transmission of the disease. Where are people most likely to catch it and get it to each other? In the case of a senior home, you've got both of those, the people most at risk and the most at risk of spread at the same time. What other things does transmission do when we weigh that as part of our vaccine priority?
Yeah, I mean, it's for sure something that we need to focus on. So if you can find someone who's a super spreader, if it's a young person who's going to a lot of parties, or, you know, someone who's coming into contact with a lot of people at work because they have to be a frontline essential health worker, and you can vaccinate that person, you potentially prevent a lot of infections. And so saving the most lives, even if that's your objective, may mean that you need to focus on halting transmission in some populations. And certainly those congregate care settings and, you know, essential workers are prioritized partly for that reason. But also, you know, for healthcare workers, partly out of reciprocity, right? These are the people not only that we need, but who are risking their lives every day to provide really important services. I mean, I think food workers too, people at grocery stores who have to be there so people can eat. You know, we tend to think of you know, healthcare workers only, but I think that these are some of the considerations that go into that prioritization.
We're having trouble with our phone lines if you're trying to call in, so bear with us. Hopefully we can get you in before the conversation is done. We did hear from Tim in La Crosse, who says we've known about the vaccines we're using for 6 months. He thinks we should be more on the ball and get them approved faster and into production and into our arms faster, basically, Nicole. And actually, yes, some of the early breakthroughs happened really early last year, of ones that ultimately got approved. What are the risks, though, of hurrying that approval process?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important that we get data on safety of the vaccines through, you know, phase 3 trials. And so it is true that, like, some countries have already approved vaccines that are not approved here, like the Oxford vaccine has been approved in the UK. The studies or whatever I've seen have suggested that there's some problems with that, and that's why the vaccine's not expected to be approved to April, as they've kind of expanded testing. I think it is important that we get access as many, you know, good vaccines that are being manufactured as possible. But really, I think the fundamental problem is that we, you know, didn't collaborate more in trying to do the research and development on these vaccines to get them developed more quickly, approved, you know, more quickly. And then when they are approved, I think they should be put in the public domain so that anybody can manufacture them, because 80% of our manufacturing capacity is in generics. And as companies, you know, have to create deals and buy up this manufacturing supply, that just raises costs, delays things, and so forth. So personally, I'd rather see that, you know, we had kind of done both the research and development and distribution side a little bit differently, with larger public investments and expanding that capacity, because I think we should be vaccinating everyone against a host of diseases as well as COVID, you know, regularly. So I think it would have been a wise investment in the long term.
Now, with medications and research, people will point toward the value of having drug companies involved. They have the profit motive to work quickly. In this case, they also had some incentives, some subsidies, pretty big ones from the U.S. government. If they had to do their vaccine in the public domain, do you worry that that would be a disincentive to go through with it?
Yeah. Well, so I think what we should have done is all on the purchaser side, collaborated through COVAX to buy up the supply together and distribute it equitably. And rather than competing, as you're saying, with countries for access to the vaccine, where Pfizer's like, no, I'm getting a more lucrative deal over here or something, and I'm not going to be able to fulfill my contract or whatever. I think that we could have, you know, some companies agree to make the vaccines available at very, very low prices, right? They've taken a no profit in a pandemic kind of pledge. And of course, that might constrain some companies' willingness to work on that at all. But what we can do is reward their investments through the same kind of advanced market commitments or agreements to, you know, pay them should the vaccine be developed, but then allow that manufacturer to be done, you know, at cost and with generic competition. And I think that would have, you know, does Pfizer really need to make $40 for every vaccine it administers globally? Is that really necessary to recoup their research and development costs? I don't buy it, I guess.
We're talking to Nicole Hassoun, professor of philosophy at Binghamton University. She looks at medical ethics. We're talking about the ethics of vaccine distribution priorities, who gets the vaccine first and next and so on. Nicole, we talked about the priority, obviously, of saving lives, of stopping transmission, of protecting different groups of workers. What about other priorities, like if a country decides, hey, the thing we really need to do is, say, get kids back into in-person schooling as much as we can? Mm-hmm. How much weight can we put on something like that to focus on, you know, teachers and school staff then?
Right. I mean, I think kids have a human right to education. I think when we're talking about something like that, that's the reason, right? It's not necessarily for the teachers that it becomes so important to help those teachers get vaccinated, but that, you know, kids are vulnerable people too. And I think their interests were neglected because they don't have a vote. They don't have like the economic pull and things that people in other groups have. So at least in many communities, it's exacerbating inequality in education and access. And for those reasons, I think those are very serious concerns as well. So, yeah.
Now, we've got a new administration as of noon Eastern time today. From what you've heard from the Biden administration, they're talking a lot about trying to ramp up a vaccine production and distribution. What kind of things are you hoping to see from the Biden administration?
Yeah, I mean, my one wish is that we will join COVAX and support putting basic health systems in place globally so that we can vaccinate people in poor countries as well as rich ones. I think it shouldn't be years before people can access a vaccine just because they happen to be born in a poor country. Some countries right now, I think they have 25 vaccines in the whole country. And I don't think that's fair. So yeah, I wish that we could join COVAX, support the global initiative. I think it's wise as a way to prepare for other pandemics and ensure equitable distribution, not only here, but everywhere.
Along those lines, in addition to the COVAX initiative, what kind of things, what kind of lessons are you hoping we learn for the next potential pandemic, whenever that might hit us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we should really take proactive steps to revisit how we're doing that pharmaceutical research and development. And so I've written a little bit about some laws that we might change. So there's the Orphan Drug Act, for instance, that President Reagan signed into law in 1983. And it basically gives companies credits for producing drugs that work for patients that don't have diseases that are major killers in the U.S. So if it's less than 200,000 people in the U.S., then they can get a bunch of tax credits and other lucrative rewards for doing research on these diseases. And some of the drugs like remdesivir that we've had out for COVID were initially, kind of using this Orphan Drug Act to make money. And they often end up being very expensive, and the orphan drugs are, you know, there's a bunch of ways that companies have come to manipulate the law. And I think that there's things that we can do to try out rewarding companies based on the health impacts of their technology. That is the number of lives they save, the amount of disability they alleviate. Because right now, pharmaceutical companies have the reason to focus most on, you know, chronic diseases of rich patients. And what we should be doing is doing research on sort of some of the worst killers that potentially pose the greatest threats to humanity, and then getting drugs available and out there at low costs. And I think the orphan drug incentives for pharmaceutical companies are very lucrative and potentially ways of rewarding them for doing research on major global health problems if we tie those rewards more to the health impacts of the technologies. And that could kind of fix some of the problems with that law. So I think there's ways we can make, you know, moderate, I guess, steps forward, as well as more transformative changes, looking to create more binding agreements to have, you know, initiatives like COVAX in the future that are adequately funded. And it's just like OPEC, you know, if OPEC, all the countries agree, you know, we're going to sell our oil at a certain price, people have to buy it at that price. If all the countries agree, we're going to create research and development and we're going to reward you at a certain price, then the pharmaceutical companies will have to accept that price. And of course, you want the price to be sufficient to get you the research and development that you need, but then you want it to be tied to the health impacts of the technologies, not to just how much of a product companies can sell to rich patients.
We'll leave it there. Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking to Nicole Hassoun from Binghamton University in New York, professor of philosophy there. She focuses on medical ethics, and we've been talking about ethics and priorities when it comes to vaccine distribution for COVID-19.